content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first story today is entitled, The Job Market is Hell, written by Annie Lowry. Young people are using ChatGPT to write their applications. Human resources is using artificial intelligence to read them. No one is getting hired. Harris started looking for his first real job months before his graduation from UC Davis this spring. He had a solid resume, he thought, a paid internship at a civic consulting firm, years of volunteering at environmental defense organizations, experience working on farms and in parks as well as in offices, a close to perfect GPA, strong letters of recommendation. He would move anywhere on the West Coast, living out of his car if he had to. He would accept a temporary part-time or seasonal gig, not just a full-time position. He would do anything, filing paperwork, digging trenches, to build his dream career protecting California's wildlife and public lands. He applied to 200 jobs. He got rejected 200 times. Actually, he clarified, he didn't get rejected 200 times. A lot of businesses never responded. Right now, millions of would-be workers find themselves in a similar position. Corporate profits are strong. The jobless rate is 4.3%, and wages are climbing in turn. But payrolls have been essentially frozen for the past 4 months. The hiring rate has declined to its lowest point since the jobless recovery following the Great Recession. 4 years ago, employers were adding 4 or 5 workers for every 100 they had on the books, month in and month out. Now they are adding 3. At the same time, the process of getting a job has become a late capitalist nightmare. Online hiring platforms have made it easier to find an opening, but harder to secure one. Applicants send out thousands of AI-crafted resumes, and businesses use AI to sift through them. What Bumble and Hinge did to the dating market, contemporary human resource practices has done to the job market. People are swiping like crazy and getting nothing back. Every time Harris logged into LinkedIn or Indeed, he would see scores of gigs that seemed like they might be a good fit. He would read a post carefully, scrub his resume, tailor an introductory note, answer the company's screening questions, hit send, and hope for the best, and hear nothing in response, again and again and again. Other job seekers describe similar experiences. In suburban Virginia, a paralegal named Martine got laid off by a government contractor in April. Like Harris, she did not want to dim her employment prospects by providing her full name. She saw plenty of jobs being advertised at nonprofits, law firms, consultancies, and universities. She sent out dozens of applications. She even got to the second round a few times, but she never came close to being hired. "I have 10 years of experience," she told me. "I would be happy if a person told me no at this point." For employers, the job market is working differently, too. Businesses receive countless ill-fitting applications, along with a few good ones, for each open position. Rather than poring over the submissions by hand, they use machines. In a recent survey, chief human resource officers told the Boston Consulting Group that they are using AI to write job descriptions, assess candidates, schedule introductory meetings, and evaluate applications. In some cases, firms are using chatbots to interview candidates too. Prospective hires log in to a Zoom-like system and field questions from an avatar. Their performance is taped, and an algorithm searches for keywords and evaluates their tone. Priya Rafford, a career trends expert at Indeed, told me she understands why job seekers feel as if their resumes are going into a void. but she argued that the online platforms make it easier for people to find open positions and that AI can get them to the next stage of the interview quicker if their applications fit an employer's needs. Still, a lot of job applicants never end up in a human-to-human process. The impossibility of getting to the interview stage spurs jobless workers to submit more applications, which pushes them to rely on ChatGPT to build their resumes and respond to screening prompts. Harris told me he does this. He used ChatGPT pretty much every day in college and finds its writing to be more professional than his own. And so the cycle continues. The surge in same-same II authored applications prompts employers to use robot filters to manage the flow. Everyone ends up in a Tinderized job search hell. For months, the economy has been in a low-hire, low-fire equilibrium. Virtually every sector of the labor market, except for healthcare, has been frozen. The amount of time a worker has spent looking for a job has climbed to an average of 10 weeks, meaning that Americans are spending 2 weeks longer on the job market than they were a few years ago. The share of American workers quitting a job has fallen to its lowest level in a decade because of concerns about rising prices and jitters about slowing growth. The equilibrium now seems to be falling apart, and a full-on recession looks likely. Black workers have experienced a dramatic surge in joblessness, in part because of the Trump administration's mass layoffs of federal employees. The 154,000 civil servants who took the White House's fork in the road deferred resignation offer will receive their last paycheck this month. More than 10% of workers under the age of 24 are searching for a job. Performance-based and strategic layoffs are increasing. Lydia Bosour of the consultancy EY Parthenon wrote in a note to clients last week, "Cracks are increasingly showing. What is a worker supposed to do? Martine and Harris and millions like them are still trying to figure that out. She keeps on applying, whereas he is doing landscaping and volunteering." Rathod said that she recommends old-fashioned networking, asking recruiters out for coffee, going to in-person job events, and surveying friends and former employers for leads. Such strategies might work if employers begin hiring again, but if not, millions more people might be left pitching their CVs into the void. Our second story, RFK Jr. is repeating Michelle Obama's mistakes. This was written by Tom Bartlett. In February of 2010, Michelle Obama launched Let's Move with a wide-ranging plan to curb childhood obesity. The campaign took aim at processed foods, flagged concerns about sugary drinks, and called for children to spend more time playing outside and less time staring at screens. The campaign was roundly skewered by conservatives. Fox News pundits such as Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity portrayed Let's Move as a nanny state plot to control the American diet, a slippery slope to the criminalization of French fries. Those ideas might sound familiar. Today, conservatives have embraced the same goals as Let's Move as part of the Trump administration's Make America Healthy Again agenda. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is essentially rerunning Obama's playbook and, in a key way, has taken it a step further. They did something we were hesitant to do, which is to identify the food industry as the root cause of the problem. Gerald Mand, a health official with the U.S. Department of Agriculture during the Obama administration, told me, but the strategy that Kennedy's HHS is using to address the problem so far, pressuring food companies to alter their products instead of introducing new regulations, is the same one that Obama relied on and will likely fall short for the same reason hers did a decade ago. The problem that Let's Move meant to solve, approximately 1 in 3 children was overweight or obese, was serious, but the vibe was cool mom fun. In a video that launched the campaign, the First Lady admitted that, along with lots of other busy parents, she sometimes defaulted to less healthy options, such as pizza, when feeding her two daughters. Her mission was twofold: encourage Americans to think a little more about their diets while pushing the food industry to make the task somewhat less onerous. To that end, Obama leaned on the power of celebrity. She slow danced with Big Bird in a grocery store, ate an apple with LeBron James at the White House, and enlisted Beyonce to lead a cafeteria full of kids in the Dougie. Her approach to food companies was friendly, and they promised to do their part. In 2011, Walmart, the nation's largest grocer, committed to removing 10% of sugar and 25% of sodium from its store brands, and to working with other brands they carried to reach those levels by 2015. Darden Restaurants, which owns Olive Garden and the Longhorn Steakhouse, among other chains, pledged to reduce calories and sodium in its restaurants by 20% over the following decade. The First Lady showed up at an Olive Garden to praise Darden, and the company put out a press release touting its competitive health and wellness commitment. The announcement seemed to signal that, thanks to Let's Move, major companies were taking seriously the role they play in public health, rather than merely engineering their offerings to be even more irresistible. Maybe a gentle nudge was all America needed to shift its food environment for the better. But as the architects of Let's Move learned, handshake deals don't carry the same weight as regulatory oversight. Today, for example, Olive Garden's signature Tour of Italy dish has 3,200 milligrams of sodium, more than double what the American Heart Association considers an optimal daily amount for adults. When I got in touch with Darden Restaurants recently and asked about the 20% pledge, a spokesperson couldn't locate any details about whether progress had been made and said in an email that the officials who were involved with the pledge are no longer with the company. Michelle Obama didn't respond to interview requests made via the Obama Foundation. Other commitments were at least partially met. A spokesperson for Walmart told me in an email that, according to its most recent analysis, done in 2017, the company had reduced sugar by more than 10% and sodium by 18%, though only in its store brands. A consortium of 16 food companies, including ConAgra, Coca-Cola, and Unilever, fulfilled a pledge to remove 1.5 trillion calories from the food they sell, according to a 2014 post from the Let's Move executive director. Even these relative successes did not make much of a difference. For one, total calorie sales can be misleading metric. When ConAgra and its peers made their pledge, the industry's total calorie sales were trending down anyway, likely due in part to the Great Recession and shrinkflation. The companies also treated all calories as if they were equal, whether they came from Pringles or peas. The consortium's pledge provided the appearance of progress when there wasn't any, Kelly Brownell, Director Emeritus of the World Food Policy Center at Duke University, told me. As for Let's Move, he said, it didn't address the heart of what is driving the poor diet in America, which is food industry actions. Today, Americans consume roughly the same amount of sodium as they did in 2013. Deborah Eschmeyer, former executive director of Let's Move, maintains that the campaign made progress, such as successfully prompting McDonald's to include apple slices in every Happy Meal. But she also acknowledges that the marketplace tends to determine what's on shelves and menus. What's going to change corporations the most is what consumers are buying, she told me. Eschmeyer said that she's been heartened by MAHA's momentum. In fact, Kennedy has arguably already more success than Obama in shifting consumer demand. As my colleague Yasmin Tayang has written, corporations have been Maha washing their products to highlight those free of artificial dyes, high fructose corn syrup, and seed oils. General Mills and Kraft Heinz have said they will remove synthetic dyes from all of their products, and Mars Wrigley announced it will offer some dye-free alternatives. The company's press releases point to evolving consumer needs and continuing an innovation journey as motivation for the changes. But these moves were clearly a win for Kennedy, who considers the dyes poisonous. If Let's Move was defined by the gentle nudges of a cool mom, the Maha approach on its surface takes the stance of a stern dad. Kennedy has portrayed the food industry as callous and predatory, saying that companies mass poison American children and could care less about the health of the American people. He's condemned the attack on whole milk and cheese and yogurt and insisted that ultra-processed food is a genocide on the American Indian. Compared with Let's Move's easygoing recommendations, children should get at least 1 hour of physical activity each day, and everyone should drink one or more glasses of water, Maha is also considerably more macho. The Obama administration placed the presidential fitness test back, and Kennedy and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth recently rolled out the Pete and Bobby Challenge, in which you try to do 100 push-ups and 50 pull-ups in less than 10 minutes. The 71-year-old Kennedy, who takes testosterone as part of what he calls an anti-aging protocol, has been known to peel off his shirt while working out in public. Noted in an interview that he was able to reach that mark in fewer than 6 minutes. This display exposes the campaign's braggadocio. Finishing the Pete and Bobby challenge would be next to impossible for all but the most dedicated gym rats, whereas the health department's own physical activity guidelines suggest that everyday tasks, such as carrying groceries upstairs and shoveling snow, can qualify as vigorous exercise, and they don't require a timer or a gym membership. Asking ordinary Americans to perform grueling feats of strength is unlikely to make a dent on the obesity rate. Most of Maha's flashiest food initiatives aren't supported by good science and would do little to improve health. The evidence connecting excess salt and sugar to poor health is much stronger than that regarding food dyes. Ezekiel Emanuel, who was the health care advisor to Barack Obama, has been critical of Kennedy's anti-vaccine views and worries that the movement's fondness for supplements of dubious merit could be a distraction. Still, Emanuel believes Maha's focus on chronic illness that's caused by obesity is 100% right. And that, so far, we haven't approached the problem as if it were a major national threat. Both Emanuel and Monde, the former USDA official, told me that they're withholding judgment until Maha manages to secure more significant concessions from the food industry. Despite the rhetoric, Kennedy, like Michelle Obama was, can be friendly with food companies that please him. He has treated handshake promises as genuine advances, and firms that make gestures toward his preference as real allies. Today's third story is America's Perone. This was written by Scott Lincecum. When the populist strongman Juan Perón ran Argentina's economy from his presidential palace in the mid-20th century, personally deciding which companies received favors, which industries got nationalized or protected, and which businessmen profited from state largesse, economists warned that the experiment would end badly. They were right. Over decades of rule by Perón and his successors, a country that had once been among the world's wealthiest nations devolved into a global laughingstock, with uncomfortable inflation, routine fiscal crisis, rampant corruption, and crippling poverty. Perónism became a cautionary tale of how not to manage an economy. President Donald Trump seems to have misunderstood the lesson. His second term has begun to follow the Perona's playbook of import substitution, emergency declarations, personal deal-making, fiscal and monetary recklessness, and unprecedented government control over private enterprise. And as with Argentina's Peronism, much of the U.S. economic policy making runs directly through the policymaking runs directly through the president himself. Trump's tendency toward Perona's policy is strongest on trade. Central to Perón's economic vision was an import substitution industrialization strategy, or ISI, that used tariffs, quotas, subsidies, localization mandates, and similar policies to push Argentines to produce domestically what they'd previously imported more cheaply from abroad. The approach was intended to fuel domestic growth, but it instead created insular and uncompetitive manufacturing industries saddled with high production costs, bloated finances, and rampant cronyism. Perversely, it also crushed Argentina's globally competitive agricultural sector by diverting resources away from it and toward protected industries. Argentinian consumers suffered from higher prices, unavailable products, and lower overall living standards. One of the most notorious examples of ISI's failure was when the government of the Peronist president, Cristina Kirchner, attempted to incubate a local electronics industry through steep restrictions on imported televisions and smartphones. The result was disastrous. Modest increase in low-value domestic assembly operations were more than offset by a market that featured substandard products, priced at double what consumers were paying in neighboring Chile. Popular items such as iPhones were simply unavailable, forcing Argentines into local black markets or shopping trips abroad. Trump's second term is following the ISI playbook in several respects, in some cases even more so than Argentina did. According to the World Bank, for example, Argentina's average tariff rate has hovered between 10 and 16% since 1992, while the Yale Budget Lab estimates that the United States now exceeds 18% and could go higher in the months ahead. National security tariffs for Trump's preferred industries, including steel, aluminum, copper, and automotive goods, tops out at 50%. Well above the 35% duty that Argentina once applied to smartphones. And with U.S.-imposed tariffs varying by product, country, and content, what was once a relatively simple tariff system has been replaced by a labyrinth of overlapping requirements that even large and sophisticated American importers struggle to navigate. Trump's Peronist tactics extend well beyond import substitution. Perón, for example, nationalized entire industries, railways, airlines, telecommunications, utilities, creating chronically loss-making state enterprises that endured for decades. Trump hasn't gone nearly that far, but is exerting an astonishing degree of government control over private companies' commercial operations. The Trump administration forced Japan's Nippon Steel to give the U.S. president a, quote, golden share, unquote, in U.S. steel in order to acquire it, and required the U.S. semiconductor firms AMD and NVIDIA to give the government a 15% cut of their China sales in exchange for export approvals. The administration also took a 15% stake in the rare earth miner MP Materials and a 10% stake in Intel, in each case making Uncle Sam the company's largest shareholder. These aren't temporary crisis measures, such as the U.S. bank and auto bailouts or wartime acquisitions of decades past. They're permanent arrangements that give the state substantial influence over private transactions and decisions. And various administration officials, as well as Trump himself, have promised more of these deals in tech, defense, and other industries. Trump also flirted with Peronism in fiscal and monetary policy. Perón took control of Argentina's central bank and used expansionary monetary policy to finance massive government spending and deficits, which led to chronic inflation. Trump, for his part, has already added trillions of dollars to the new U.S. debt via the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, while also seeking to smash the independence of the Federal Reserve in order to adopt expansionary U.S. monetary policy in the face of still warm inflation. Perhaps the president's most Peronist trait is the way in which he enacts his policies. Peronis, for example, acquired and then routinely deployed broad emergency powers to implement their statist economic policies quickly and unilaterally. Trump has similarly declared multiple national emergencies to justify his rapid imposition of global tariffs, as well as extra penalties for China, India, and Brazil, under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. Should the Supreme Court decide that those emergency moves are lawful, Trump will have effectively unlimited power over tariffs and trade, a startling expansion of executive authority and a departure from our Constitution's separation of powers. Trump's first term featured a trade regime that was at least open and transparent. This time around, deals are being made behind closed doors, and special treatment is being earned from political connections and power. Those without the president's ear don't stand a chance. The centralization of economic decision-making is decidedly Peronist, rewarding friends and punishing enemies through state power. Trumpism isn't full-blown Peronism yet. Large parts of the U.S. economy fortunately remain outside the president's crosshairs and grasp, but each emergency declaration, Oval Office favor, and presidential intervention into private enterprise moves us closer to the Argentine model and will make reversing course more difficult. Peronism created vested interests, companies, cronies, unions, government officials, and more, that became dependent on the state and successfully resisted systematic reforms for decades. Trump is creating a similar dynamic today. Companies are making billion-dollar investment decisions based on backroom deals, unilateral policy, and personal promises. Highly publicized exemptions, equity stakes, and special favors are encouraging other private parties to seek similar treatment, and they're giving government officials more reason and precedent to intervene further. Throw in tens of billions of dollars in tariff revenues to which the government will become accustomed, and the risks of entrenchment are clear. When a nation's economic policy depends on personal whims and relationships rather than consistent rules applied to equally to everyone, it has abandoned market capitalism. Argentina took almost 80 years to begin moving back. Let's hope the United States moves sooner. You've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.